We made this. Welcome to the X-Cast. The truth is in here. I'll be your host today, Russ Hugo, and I had the pleasure of speaking with actor Jerry Hardin, famous, of course, for playing Deep Throat on The X-Files, but also an incredibly long and successful career as a character actor, both on stage, screen, and television. Be speaking a little bit about his acting history, The X-Files, as well as some of his hobbies and what he's been up to lately. Hope you enjoy. Hello. Well, thank you again for taking the time to share with us.
Well, a lot of it is a long time ago, and certainly X-Files, what is that, it's almost 20 years ago now, and it's a remarkable experience, I think. I get fan mail from fans in Europe and in Central Asia and occasionally in Asia. And for a while, I thought maybe they had just gotten it. For some reason or another, it had never been allowed. But recently, I've gotten fan mail from Russia and a couple of places that said, "We've been watching you since we were a child." Oh, my God. Oh. So it's been a long time.
Yeah, not to put you on the spot, but I too was one of those who, when I was very young, started season one, and the first episode I ever watched was Deep Throat. I missed the pilot. So I'm one of those. The podcast I'm involved with, the X-Cast, has a really great international audience, and that's been something fun to see, is how popular it is overseas. It's interesting because it's so steeped in U.S. lore, U.S. politics and history and the rest, that it has such a broad appeal internationally.
It's extraordinary. It was extraordinary when we were doing it too. I mean, that first season, we were not at all sure that it would ever survive. We were way down in the ratings, about as low as you could get and still be on the television. So it was hard to know. But lo and behold, it was this extraordinary experience for people. And I thought the writing was exceptionally good, especially in that first season. I was delighted that we turned out to survive. And Deep Throat was a particularly interesting role. The guy who was writing that material was really good at sort of the elliptical aspect of Deep Throat. That was a delight to play, to have information that you want to communicate, but not really get down to facts, just to imply. So that was great fun.
I was going to wait till the end to maybe think if we could go chronologically, but since we're here, one of the listeners had a question that relates to that, and I wonder if I could probe a little bit deeper there. So Ibrahim asked, basically, because the character seemed to have been written very ambiguously, like you're saying, elliptical, we don't know what the motives are, and you having to approach it and be a character that knows so much information, but not necessarily actually know what he knows or know the motivation. That's a tricky thing to play and to keep a balance of somebody who the fans rewatching or people watching the first time don't know how to approach the character, but yet there is so much charisma for somebody who could be malicious or could be kind. We don't know. How did you approach that aspect? And did you create a backstory for the character in your head?
Well, I didn't have any more than you had, really, except that for me, this was a man, obvious important connections and man of power in some kind of a situation where what he needed to communicate would have destroyed his avenues to information. So he was looking for an avenue. And it turns out that Mulder was a good possibility. And that was a very enjoyable aspect of him. I felt that it was important to maintain the fuzziness of it, for example, because the source material that he had to offer was something that could get cut off pretty quickly if anybody recognized where it was coming from. So it was a pleasure to handle it and to consider from a character viewpoint, how do I reach this man, this woman, so that they get the message, but they don't really know where I got that information, or indeed what exactly I'm talking about, but they sort of know. I could tell that by their response to the information. So it was a really challenging, fun thing to play. We don't often get things like that in television. And this was a fun thing to do. I really enjoyed the writing that was given me. And I think it worked extremely well. I happened to be traveling a good deal during the time that we were shooting a lot of that. And people all over the world, that sounds a little encompassing, but it turns out that I was, during that time, was in Europe and then Russia and in Central Asia. And everywhere there were people who recognized me and were curious about Deep Throat. So it was a lovely kind of thing.
The ideas that you're talking about in the performance, the fact that you don't have that information as a performer, in hindsight, we can look back and actually see that that performance pretty much sums up the appeal of the X-Files. The fact that you can sustain a mystery for that long of a show and to be able to have it just dance back and forth with this ambiguity, but continue to be charismatic, particularly out of the gate with that performance, which could have been played, I think, a little bit more villainous or a little bit more of a mentor. Solely, that seems very much with a beneficial intent. But the fact that you taking the script and then at the end of season one, of course, with what happens, I think lays a lot of the emotional groundwork for the way the audience approaches the show. So to me, speaks for a reason why the character and the performance has such longevity. And it's even though it was season one, and then there were additional appearances later, the continuity of the performance resonates throughout the rest of the series.
As I said, it was exceptionally well written, and that's always wonderful to have. And because there was no definitive information, it had to be suggested, it had to be hung out to interest the Mulder and Jillian's character. And that was fun to play with all the time. And my sense of the character grew in that I became aware that this was part of a crusade on his part to get something done about this, because not unlike our present situation in this country, it was necessary to get some information out, but not to destroy the source. So that's a fun thing to play with, and to it apparently read well to the audience, because Deep Throat had all kinds of levels of people. I'll tell you a funny story. I did a one-man show of Mark Twain in Edinburgh, and I was asked to come over to Glasgow to a sci-fi shop and sign some autographs and talk to some fans and whatnot. And so I went over some of the time off I had. And I expected, you know, what did I know in Scotland and how it was. When I arrived there, there was this line clear down the block of people outside of the shop waiting for me to show up. And lo and behold, about half of that line was teeny boppers. And I've never been in a situation like that. And these were teeny boppers, most of whom, for whatever reason, wanted me to sign their body parts. I signed arms and backs and the tops of their hands. And I kept saying, I have a piece of paper here. Would you like that? No, no, no. Put it here. Put it on my elbow. So it was really a strange kind of thing for Deep Throat as well as Jerry Harden, I'll tell you.
For all you know, there's now a bunch of people running around with tattoos of that signature. So that's often what they'll do. What year about do you think that was?
Oh, dear. A long time ago. I honestly don't remember. I do remember that I was in Edinburgh early on doing this show, but I can't remember what those dates were.
Again, looking at your IMDb with how many projects you've been involved with over the many decades, it's, you know. But just in case there happened to be a mnemonic device to help remember the year, I thought I'd ask. But
my wife is good at that. If she were around, she could probably tell you the year right on the nose. I'm not good at it. I feel the same way about lines. Have fans approach me and say, "Oh, I saw such and such a show, and you had this line where you said just blah 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 blah, whatever it was." I said, "Oh, really? Okay. Well, do you remember that? What were you thinking?" I said, "Look, I've been an actor for 50 or 60 years, and I don't remember the things that I've done. After all, I've worked a reasonable amount of time, and they don't stick. You do a show and you move on. But I'm delighted that they know the script better than I do."
I have one other question related to what we've been talking about, and then maybe I'd like to go back and talk about your early work, if you didn't mind. Cardwyn Foley, who is another co-host and listener, asked this question about the role with Deep Throat in hindsight, but especially at the time, was, so she describes it as a number of father figures for Mulder. So when you think about the character's attitude toward Mulder and the family, did that influence the performance? Because that's an ongoing thing. And I wonder how much the writers saw in your performance with Duchovny and built that out. Because it's a trope that's explored, but that first one was very foundational. Not just a mentor, but almost like a father figure.
Well, I'm not aware that the writers picked up on that, though they may very well have done. David and I discussed to some length what was the relationship between these two and what would eventually develop as time went on. But of course, we never found out. But there was, you know, in the morning when we're sitting in the makeup truck, that was a lot of conversation there about that. At some point in time, I remember having conversation with Chris Carter about it, just in passing. And he said, "Well, I don't know, maybe we'll find out." And I said, "Oh, you're in the same boat we are, and you know, we'll find out."
Well, it's surprising how well rounded the characters come across when the performers don't know, and you're making it up, doing your best with the backstory, and it just was a phenomenal success. What a challenge it must have been. So if I can jump back, just I was actually going to open up with a little bit of a bio, but maybe I'll kind of jump in here now, if you don't mind, just to kind of give some background to the listeners that you grew up in Texas and then you attended Southwestern University in Georgetown, also in Texas. But there you got a Fulbright to study at RADA in London. It's very prestigious. Yeah, so I'd love just to learn a little bit more about your early training and then into RADA and beyond, and what were your experiences like?
I had originally, when I applied for the Fulbright, I originally wanted to go to the Old Vic School, but my timing was off. They closed the Old Vic School the year that I would have gone over. So they just placed me at the Royal Academy, and it turns out was fine. I was delighted to have the opportunity to be in England and to go to school there. But it was an extraordinary adventure for me in theater. There was, at the time that I was there, the Bristol Old Vic and the I've forgotten the other company, but both of those companies were doing Shakespeare plus the Old Vic itself, and they were doing it. You could go there, or you could. They brought them into London, and being a Fulbright scholar, I was invited to all kinds of aspects of that, sometimes to rehearsals, sometimes to openings. Sometimes we were invited to be to fill the house when the show was beginning to fade. So I saw lots of shows several times, and it was an extraordinary adventure to be able to do that. And fortunately, we had plenty of money to do it from the scholarship, but there were many times that we just walked in. It wasn't a matter of it. We were invited because we were either just students at RADA, or because we were Americans, or because there were a number of Fulbright students there. So the exposure was mind-boggling. And also, what was his name? Beaumont, the producer Beaumont, was doing a broad range of things in a kind of what I would call an off-Broadway theater. And they were doing wild shows over there, things that you never see. They saw, they did restoration comedies, and they did Greek theater, and with good people. I mean, Gielgud worked there, and a lot of the well-known stars worked there. And this was work that you never see anywhere else. Nobody does it. And they still don't do it. I mean, it's just, you don't see it around. So it was a delight to be there and be exposed to that extraordinary theater experience. Plus, I enjoyed being there. I enjoyed England, liked London very much. It was a life involved experience for me. And I had been at RADA, the teachers there were trying to get me to have a good British accent. And after 2 years of that, I had a pretty good one. But when I got back to the United States, It took a while for me to fit in over here. So it was fun. But I got away with it. I ended up doing the park circuit in London in a thing called England's Elizabeth. And nobody could tell that I wasn't a native Brit doing the show. So I faked them out.
All of that linguistic dialectology there paid off, because think of some of course, doing the Mark Twain and everything else. There's, you've got the knack, and I wonder how much of that RADA, they seem to, I'm not an expert, from other interviews I've heard of other actors who go there, they seem to put a big emphasis on dialectology and pronunciation and the rest.
Yes, there was a very good voice teacher there, and he was fun to work with, and There were several Americans there at the same time that I was, and we found him helpful, and we teased him a lot because he had a wonderful, big, booming voice. And I think he used to do it on purpose to show off, because he'd often lecture like this, talking through his hand all the time, his big voice going on. Just, come on. Everybody knows. But he was showing us, I suppose, that doesn't matter what the obstacles are, you can get it out there. And boy, is that ever different now. One of the things that I'm so aware of is actors, at least in this country, tend to mumble a lot. And when you see performances on stage particularly, and you can't hear the actors, you're saying, hey, I didn't come here to hear you mumble. I want to get the story.
Going back, you started off when you were young doing local theater productions. And then I'm assuming you studied drama also at the University of Georgetown. Is that the case?
I did. I majored in theater. I was an assistant to the head of the department. It turns out that the theater they had there was in an old building and had just simply been an auditorium for speaking. So there was a pretty shallow stage, and it was not really designed for theater. And I came with a number of skills that could be used. I grew up on a ranch, and we did carpentry work, and we did electrical work, and we, you know, dug ditches, did the whole thing. So when I came to college and found that we had a theater that needed some improvement, I contributed my time to it and got to know the head of the department very well. And they essentially took me on as an assistant to the theater department. I was in every show that was done at the university when I was there, and I built the sets for most of them. So the answer to your question is yes, I was intensely involved.
Wow.
In the theater department.
No free time, but it sounds like fun, though.
It was. It was a very good preparation for being a professional. Also knowing from, you know, the very beginnings of a show to the very end of the show, all of the work that takes to tell that story.
Yeah.
It was lovely. I enjoyed it. And then, of course, out of college, I went to RADA. That just exploded that whole kind of experience, and it was quite lovely.
And then you didn't stop for another... many, many more decades of, so it sounds like the early life prepared you to stay busy, if nothing else. What drew you to early on to drama and enough to pursue it at university?
It was certainly not straight like an arrow. As a child, I was essentially shy, but I didn't mind showing off, and my mother was involved in our local church, and they were always looking for kids who were not afraid to get up in front of the church and do whatever. And I played lots of roles for them. I even played a wise man, as I recall, and the reason it sticks in my head is that they wanted to make me an old man, and they put moss on my face to give me a beard. And that moss was like having briars on your face. And I remember that very well indeed. But it just seemed fine. If I was on stage, I felt free to do whatever I was asked to do and to play around with it as well. Then I went off to military school in my high school years, and I ran into a young woman there who had majored in theater, and she was young and fresh at the military school. And she and I built a theater there. They had no theater. And she and I built a theater and really brought it to life. They had done an occasional play, but she came with lots of knowledge about how to do these things. And I came with the primary skills of electricity and carpentry and that kind of thing. And again, we were in an old building that had a stage, but it wasn't built for theater. So we made it for theater. We made lights. I also worked in the kitchen at the military school. And we took gallon cans that food came in and made lights out of them. She would order in the gels, and we'd use clothespins to hold the gels on them. And so for the first time, they had actual theater productions with light and light control. She was sharp, and she helped me, and I helped her. And so...
Sounds like that could be a fabulous premise for a short film.
We had great fun, and we did some interesting shows. We were breaking boundaries there and able to get away with it because it was all about what goes on in the theater and not within the boundaries of military conduct and discipline.
So can you think of any examples of what kind of shows? I'm sorry to talk over. I apologize.
But. You know what? I don't remember the names of them now. They're long gone. I have one recall that's a funny story. We had a scene in this play where we needed to shoot somebody, and they didn't have a proper property room, and we had guns all over the place. You know, it was a military school. So I said, well, let's just get one of the pistols that we use around here and make some blanks for it. And she said, okay, let's do that. So I found out how to do that, and we made blanks. And then I said, now, we need to get the community to come into the military school to see our shows. So I think we should commit a crime on the streets and get a crowd, and then we'll get in the newspapers. And she said, oh, that's a great idea. Let's do that. So she got me an appointment with the local sheriff. And I said, we have guns and we have several blanks, and we want to pull this stunt down in Georgetown, which is a small village, really. And I said, do we have your permission to fire the gun in town? He said, yeah, that sounds like fun. And I said, okay, let's do it. So we created an event where there's a guy coming out of a store, and another guy is standing around out there. And when the guy comes out of the store, he whirls on him and fires, and the guy drops. And then there were stairs that went upstairs to the second floor, and we knew there was an escape on the other side. So this guy would run up those stairs, then down the other stairs, and disappear. And then myself and a bunch of other theater students would be hanging around with publicity leaflets. And we would hand them out to the audience. So that was the you know, people who gathered around after the shooting. The one problem with it was there was a state trooper in town, and he was in the courthouse. And when he heard gunfire, he came barreling us out to see what was going on. The whole audience was, of course, by that time, you know, half of the city was there, town was there, and they all had versions to tell him and whatnot. And we were so stunned that the state cop was there, and we were wondering how to handle it. And finally, we told him that, hey, we had permission and we're doing a show, come see it, will you? And he was not really happy about it. But I said, we had permission, you know, the sheriff knows we were going to do it, and we had permission, and we at the military school, so we handle guns all the time, and we got away with it, and for that show, we had a hell of an audience. I think we did shows like three nights, and we had good audiences all three nights.
That is a radical series of events. It is a different world to be supported in something like that by the community and by the other people at the school and to be able to get away with that. Wow. Yeah, that's a successful career right there, there and done.
Well, I suppose if we did it now, they'd want to put us in jail for firing a firearm on the street. But
yeah, if you survive.
Yes.
There may be some retaliatory fire from people who don't know better. It's interesting, again, I'm coming at it as a layperson, but hearing about your work compared to other people I know or I've talked to or read about, it doesn't seem that common to have people that are as well-versed in all of those other things like set building and lights and just making things. And I know there's a lot of creative people in there, but often, especially when I hear about people who go to RADA, when I've listened to interviews with actors in England, it's very linear in the sense of I'm an actor, I serve, but you're bringing all of this and how you were able to capitalize on it. It's not just that you had it, but you also had the initiative at the military school and at the school to go, hey, let's build another theater. That is something else to start a career with.
I found it very interesting and very challenging. And it was... something that I could do that was rewarding, that people around me, teachers and audiences, enjoyed what we were doing, and we got compliments for it. And also in that period, I began to get honors in some way or another. I belonged to speech organizations and theater organizations, and I would get elected president, or I would be speech guy of the year or something. And so while I hadn't made a distinct decision about being an actor, that's mostly what I was doing, and I got a lot of kudos for it. So it was feeding that enjoyment that I had. And when I won, I went back. This was in high school that I did this stunt and whatnot. Then I went back to high school, and then in college, I got a lot of feedback. And then on top of that came the Fulbright. So it was, life was sort of pushing me in that direction, if you will. By the time I came to England, I'd pretty well made up my mind that's what I was going to do. I was very well aware that it was not the best way in the world to make a living, but I thought I would give it a try for a few years. And if I couldn't make it, then I would do something else. I don't know.
And it sounds like you had many skills to fall back upon, which makes it potentially a little easier than a lot of people. And what you said earlier, the more you speak makes even more sense about how having that background on set building and lights and running shows and things like this makes you a better actor because you understand all that. And that makes a lot of sense hearing all of this other background.
Well, it was great fun and I enjoyed doing it. And I was well supported in most of those ventures, and even at RADA, I don't know whether you know about the history of RADA, but during the war, their theater got bombed out, and when I went there, most of the building had been redone, except the theater was still in process, if you will, and they didn't have money to build sets. I ran into a guy there who later became my best friend, but he also had skills. And when we would end up in shows, we would build sets for them. We'd get pasteboard and paint and a little wood here and there and build sets. And of course, the people at Rado were pleased about that and happy to use our skills. And it didn't cost them anything. So, and we enjoyed it, and we felt like we had contributed to the eventual success or failure of the show.
Yeah. It's an unusual amount of investment and passion. And that just definitely shows you picked the right career. History has proved that right. But even at that point, just looking back at a lot of your work in various genres, but you were never, ever pigeonholed into anything. And you crossed so many genres, including more standard traditional drama or theater performance. You've done Westerns, social issue dramas, historical dramas, science fiction, not just like a single instance, but repetition and a lot of very high profile things. So you seem very comfortable and very successful, where it's often, I think, taboo or a risk for other actors. You might get pigeonholed or stuck in there, and you seem to be able to jump between them and be very comfortable. And wondering, A, what are your thoughts about that? And did you have any concerns about being pigeonholed or the extreme fan culture that comes along with being associated with cult television like The X-Files or Star Trek? Overall, as you navigated your career, as you look back, that divide and the breadth of your work. And
as a character actor, you are basically hired because they expect you to take what picture they've painted with words and bring it to life. And that job is the same in whatever story you're telling. You have to find life in this. And the question becomes in lots of people's minds, well, how do you deal with playing a murderer, or you deal with playing a scoundrel? And actually, those things are wonderful to play because it gives you the freedom to explore all of that without paying the penalty to society that comes from it. So it's just doing the job. And I really enjoy being an actor, and I think most actors do.
But you didn't have any concerns with, if you take on too many Western roles, that, oh, I'm going to be pigeonholed as a Western actor? Maybe ask it this way. You seem to be, as a character actor, open to working in a lot of, and sometimes very cult-heavy genres, on screen in particular. Was it just like, oh, it's fun work, and you didn't even think about the genre issue? Or did you actually enjoy working in these more unique genres? That makes sense, or a particular preference for specific genres?
For an actor, a job is a job. And you need jobs, and you need to go where you can go, where people are interested in you and what you can bring. So it really is not that carefully designed. And I very seldom turn down work. I was always happy to work. I found it exciting to do and challenging to do. And I did fall into a kind of category, I think, in the business without my intending to. As time went on, I got lots of roles where I was the guy who brings a ton of information to the story. And that's not an easy chore, because you generally are kind of in the background of scenes and whatnot. And then they give you 3 pages of stuff that is all pushing the storyline forward, so they don't have to show all of that. Well, it's all very good from the writer's viewpoint, but to make that interesting and keep it from being blah, 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 blah to the audience, but to have them have it be experiential is a pretty big challenge sometimes. depending on how good the writers are and how good the actor is. But I apparently got a reputation for finding ways to make that come alive. And I ended up doing a bunch of those. That's the only categorization that I can think of that happened to me, is that I often found myself with roles that were really just about moving the story. So I did the best I could.
It was obviously very successful, because all of that, again, feeds back into Carter casting you as Deep Throat, who else can not only deliver all this info, but has to hold this info in their head without even knowing that info exists, and to be able to present that weight there. But I did have a follow-up question, which may be a dead end, because it's, you may have already answered it, because one of the genres that I saw that was of interest is you had done quite a bit of work on topics related to social, political, or historical issues. And I wonder if that was something that you sought, or was it simply because of this fact that you're really good at delivering large amounts of information, and those types of media pieces need to get a lot of information out to make it more real, and that was another reason why they sought you out?
I'm not aware of I mean, I didn't really pick and choose things under those circumstances. My feeling is that if you are an actor, it's your business to bring life to the character, regardless of who or what he is. And so I was never on some kind of social path. I was really on the path of getting a job. And
it worked. So
that's the things that I ended up doing were just things that came by way of doing. I mean, my experience with Mark Twain, for example, I went in to read for Mark Twain, and I thought that's an interesting role to play, and I'll give it a shot at that. And whatever I did, they hired me. And during the shooting, it was in two parts, if you recall. And when we were shooting the first part, the line producer pulled me aside and said, have you ever done Twain on stage? And I said, no, I haven't. And he said, you should do Mark Twain. And I said, Hal Holbrook will put out a contract on me. He's got that covered. He says, no, it isn't on that material. You should do Twain. And so subsequently, the director of the episode said the same thing to me. And so they got my attention. And between that first shooting and the second episode, I read a ton of Twain. And I really thought, God, he's so funny and he's so au courant. I mean, there's a man's been dead almost a year and it sounds like he's talking about today. And so when I went back to do the second episode, I said on the soundstage, well, you guys talk me into it. I'm going to do Mark Twain. And the director said, good, when do we start? And I said, well, I don't have a script. I just have an idea. And he said, call me when you have a script. And sure enough, I did. I called him, and we did a production of my first script of Mark Twain in Barter Theater in Abingdon, Virginia, which is a theater I had worked in years and years before. And I knew the people who ran the theater. We had a really lovely experience there. The first night we did it, the house was a little more than half full, just about half full. And the second night, it was chock-a-block. And the rest of the week, we had full houses the whole time. So we felt very well rewarded for our work. So I became enamored of doing Twain and eventually put that show out on the road, and it became something I just had in my back pocket when I didn't have other work. I would try to book Twain somewhere. And over a period of a decade or so, I did that. And eventually I took it to Scotland and played it for about 2 weeks there. And that produced offers. I played it in Ireland. And I had a really fun offer from a guy in Saudi Arabia that wanted me to come be in the art. They have a big art show every year. And it was Jordan. And they have a big art show there. And the guy said, you know, we'd love for you to come and play for a couple of weeks here. And my first thought was, I don't know how well Twain's humor will go over in English in an Arabic country. You know, it's an interesting opportunity. So I followed up on it. And he said, well, the art show will put you up and we'll pay you, but we need you to fly yourself in. And I said, well, I don't think so. That's not the way I work. If you want me to come, you have to pay my expenses then and pay me. And so that didn't work out. But it would have been an interesting opportunity. Turns out that the King of Jordan actually was educated in the United States and speaks English really well. I don't know how many other people do, but he did. Anyway, it was fun, and I ended up playing Twain in places. I played in England, I played on the continent, and Twain was really good to me. I enjoyed using his words and his persona very much, and for me it worked very well. Audiences received it well. It was a good thing, a kind of insurance policy I kept in my back pocket.
What a serendipitously, is that a little bit of push. You stumble across something, and to have that degree of success and longevity on it, that's got to be a fabulous feeling. Very rewarding.
It was rewarding. It was fun.
And he's such a rich character and so much work to pull on. It's not like a one-note thing. Could maybe get famous for portraying something that's more characterized, if this can make sense. It's very shallow in the cultural appeal or in the humor, but you get somebody that has so much you can pull on and so much material you can work with. Of all the characters to like strike gold with or famous historical figures, you know, you can't do much better than Twain, I think, in that sense. So,
he tried it all out, you know, he experimented with it all over. So you can pick up the stories that worked over a period of years, but she was not afraid to use over and over again. And of course, his own sense of humor and his sense of the human being was universal in many ways. So
he's got the political edge to it too, which, like you said, still keeps the relevance. And
yes,
he keeps you forever getting bored of it, because why have we not learned our lesson sometimes?
Yeah.
So I don't want to take up too much more of your time, but I did have one other question, if I can ask on behalf of a listener, about going back, kind of wrap up with the X-Files work. And Chandru Ravindran was wondering, did you stay in contact much with the cast and the show, in the sense of, did you ever work with or talk with Stephen Williams about his character and the relationship to yours? Because I know it's a in-universe thing, and how the scripts don't tell you too much and how you had to talk with Duchovny, considering, even though you weren't shown on screen really in the same way, how did you ever have a chance to talk with him?
Actually, I didn't. You probably know that most of this was shot in Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
So part of my whole experience with them was having to fly into Vancouver. And I happened to be fortunate enough to be working a fair amount in those days. And they were very good about arranging for me to come in. I'd fly in at night after I'd been somewhere else working. I would fly in, get up in the morning and go shoot for a day or two and go sometimes from the soundstage to the airport. And they were always accommodating in that respect. So, for example, Jillian, I never even met her except in the scene that we did together when they shot me. That's the first connection that we have. So most of my time was spent with David, and we usually shot for a day or two, maybe three, and then I went away. So my relationship was really with David and all of the cameramen and the sound men and producers, etc. Really hardly ever saw Chris Carter. He did show up. He showed up the day that they shot my death. He was there for that. And he would occasionally come around. I know that he saw all the material, but he wasn't necessarily on the set. So our relationship was very much boss and hired hand.
Hopefully they at least gave you a cake after they shot you.
Well, actually, when we shot that, you know, we shot it, needed to shoot it at night. So everybody was under duress. We had been shooting all night long. And we were about to have sunrise. And so they were hurrying to get the shot in. And we did get it in before the sun came up. And it was almost as if the sun timed it, because they got the shot, they got the coverage. And I said, okay, we got it. It's a wrap. And about then the sun flashed out and Chris was there. And Chris said, come with me. Let me take you in the car. And we went down to where all the trucks were in the dressing rooms. And most of the cast and everything was there. And he opened some champagne and they bid me a happy last show, which was very nice.
I'm glad to hear that happened. But it's also fun hearing you talk about it again, how short amount of time you actually were involved, but how impactful it is. Although we need to get going, I did want to touch on it and recommend people check it out, because I spent some time looking at the website bonesculpture.com. And if people are not familiar with it, I would recommend checking it out, that you have been doing some really impressive sculpture work. It sounds like working with bone, I read 35 years about is what it sounds like.
Yes. You know, an actor has downtime, because every time you get a job and it wraps, you never know if you're ever going to get another job. It isn't as if you had a place to go the next day. And a lot of actors have problems with that downtime. And it leads to too much smoking or too much drinking or too much drugs. And my downtime I spent sculpting gave me a great deal of pleasure, and I enjoyed the things that I did. And it started a number of years ago when I was traveling around in various theaters, and I started out with papier-mâché, and then a gallery owner saw my work and wanted me to go work in something other than paper. And so he said, would you be interested in working with one of my sculptors to learn to do bronze? And I said, absolutely, that sounds fabulous. So I did that, learned to cast in bronze. And I cast in bronze for quite some time. So I've been doing it for a number of years, and bone was an accident. My father and I were riding on the ranch, and we came up on a skeleton of a horse, which is unusual. Ordinarily, the wolves or the dogs would drag the bones away, and they're scattered. But this one was almost all there. And we stopped and he was telling me which horse it was. And he was his old horse. He was sorry to see it die. And as we were talking about it, I noticed that there were a lot of bones that weren't a shaft with knobs on the end. There were all kinds of shapes and wonderful things. So I picked up some and put them in the saddlebags, and I took them back to my home and began fiddling with them and carving on them. And I got to where I really liked what was there. And I've been carving bone ever since. And it turns out to be a very good material. It only sunlight and water are its only enemies. Otherwise, it lasts forever. I mean, look at the things they found in the pyramids. The bones are still there. Bone has an indeterminate life if you keep sunshine and water off of it. That's what kept me going when I couldn't get a job. So I did that. And I'm still doing it. So
the restrictions of bone, you get a shape, you don't get a block, you get a shape, and you got to work with that shape that nature gave you, and to see some of the results. Yeah, really beautiful.
I find that exciting. I see bone as a raw material, but I also see it as a kind of expression of nature, which ought to be used if it can be. And so if I can find the natural form that says something about what I'm doing, I will use that. And I think it's lovely. I enjoy using that. And I very much attach to the texture, if you will, of the bone, and that you can polish it or you can leave it raw. And there's not only the bone surface that we usually see, but there's the cancellous bone inside. And all of that has emotional impact as well. I've had almost everybody who sees the sculpture wants to touch it, which is, I consider, a compliment. And with bone, it doesn't bother it. I mean, with bronze, you can screw it up because it'll polish if you keep touching it. Bone, that won't happen, and it doesn't get dirty easily. But I've also done some where you reveal that spongy, cancellous bone inside. And I've had people see that and they say, oh, that reminds me of death. That's it. And I said, no, why? It's just a wonderful texture. Look at all that. And that is the strength of the bone. The animal depended on that to make it functional. Otherwise, the bone would break. You need, so all that cancellous bone gives it strength, and it's a kind of strength. There's nothing that suggests death, it suggests a vital life to me. And so it's interesting that there's those emotional responses, regardless of what the form turns out to be. People respond to it emotionally, and that's, I think, a good thing.
Can't argue with that. And the challenge, again, as somebody who's not worked with it, but to think of the fairly high contrast aesthetics of the smooth outer bone and then the inner very harsh, and again, not saying in a negative way, but so much contrast in the structure on the inside versus the outside, and to be able to work with those two. I guess what I'm trying to say, it seems like a medium you have to be very careful, and a lot of thought is going into it to get that balance right and to get the shapes to come out the way they do. It's really interesting stuff. I recommend people go to the website again. We'll put the link in the show notes, but bonesculpture.com is pretty easy to remember. So that should be there. Yeah, I just wanted to say we really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to speak with us. It's very kind. And while the podcast is free for anyone to listen to, we want to encourage people who speak with us. If there's a charity that you like to support that you would want to nominate, and then we can recommend and tell our listeners that they could go and support and give back as a thank you to you, to that charity, to support them on your behalf. Is there a charity that you can think of that might be appropriate for that?
I hesitate to push anything. I myself find that my computer is loaded with requests for money all the time, which is really disturbing. But the acting business is a disaster for the entertainment industry. And if people would contribute to the Actors Fund, either for SAG or for Actors Equity, that would be greatly appreciated. God knows they need it. So many people, especially in theater, are in deep trouble. It's just, there's a scheme of things for actors in New York where they work, and when they don't work, they have jobs that are that you can go in and out of, like waiting tables, like working in offices, or part-time work. And that's all gone. So they're not making money to eat and live on. And there's no end to it. If it were going to be over, tomorrow or even in months, it would be a different thing. But it's a terrible thing that's happening to the entertainment industry. I'm sure there are others as well, but I'm particularly aware of that people who don't have money are seriously hurting. So the unions would be delighted to have whatever you'd like to send along.
Great. Thank you. And a lot of people are struggling, but if some folks who are listening who have a little bit of extra money, that's great. So we appreciate you recommending that. We'll put a link to both of those groups that you mentioned in the podcast notes too, so that'll be easier for them to find, in addition to Bone Sculpture.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you, of course, for sharing your time and for your acting work. And we look forward to all future performances and future sculptures. And
well, thank you very much. Enjoyed it. Well, thank you for your time.
And I hope you have a great week, all things considered, with the stresses of the world. So,
yes.
Caveats are important these days. So
it is. But it sure is. Well, hopefully there's an end in sight. We'll see.
With you there. Thank you once again.
Take care.
You too. We hope you enjoyed the interview. And until next time, as always, trust no one.
The X-Cast and X-Files podcast was created by Tony Black and is produced and hosted by Carl Sweeney, Sarah Blair and Kurt North.
You can find the podcast on Twitter at the X_cast, on Facebook by typing in the X-Cast, and in our group, X-Files Basement, the X-Cast podcast fan group, and on Instagram at the X-Cast pod.
Don't forget, you can support the show by becoming a member on Patreon. Our patrons get early access to episodes, behind-the-scenes chats with our hosts and a thriving community of X-Files, and other premium interviews and specials. To find out more and subscribe, you can go to patreon.com/thexcast. That's patreon.com/thexcast.
We are also part of the We Made This podcast network, full of popular culture shows, including our Millennium series, The Time Is Now. You can find all of our shows at our website, wemadethispod.com, or via Twitter at @wemadethispod.
Thanks for listening and keep watching the skies.